Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Greg Dalton, Vice President of the Commonwealth Club and leader of our new climate change initiative. Today we're discussing global climate change and economic growth and equity. The United Nations Development Program just released a report on climate change here at the Commonwealth Club, and we have a distinguished panel of experts to discuss how countries and people around the world can sink carbon while raising living standards, particularly among the world's poorest citizens. Our panel includes Dr. Larry Brilliant, Executive Director of Google.org. During his multifaceted career, Dr. Brilliant has been a technology entrepreneur and CEO and helped lead a World Health Organization program to eradicate smallpox. Ad Melkert is Under Secretary General of the United Nations. He is also Associate Administrator of the United Nations Development Program. Prior to joining the UN, Mr. Melkert was on the board of the World Bank, where he was an executive director, and he had a career in the Dutch Labor Party, serving as a member of parliament and minister of social affairs and employment. Nancy Fund is a managing director at J.P. Morgan. She co-heads J.P. Morgan's $75 million Bay Area Equity Fund, a double bottom line private equity fund that invests in startup companies located in or near lower-income neighborhoods in the San Francisco Bay Area. The first President Bush and President Clinton both appointed her to national advisory boards on technology and education. Andrea Gardner is Sustainable Solutions Manager at CH2M Hill, a $5 billion engineering firm that designs large factories, power plants, water systems, etc. around the world. She trains engineers and scientists and planners in the basic concepts of sustainable energy and advises on applying sustainability to the firm's projects. She told us earlier she also drives a car powered by French fry oil. Is that right? Yeah, potato oil. So please welcome our panelists. Mr. Melkert, let's begin with you. We've heard a lot about the science and economics of climate change, and this report puts a human face on global warming. It opens with a quote from Martin Luther King and frames climate change as a human rights issue. Could you explain that view of the link between climate change and human liberty?
Well, thank you, Greg, first of all, for being in this meeting, large turnout, distinguished panel, and really the attention for the topic that is badly needed, and it's more than science and economy. The climate panel of the UN has really underscored, and there's now near consensus in the world, that there is a big issue. Professor Nick Stern has made a landmark economic report showing the economic consequences and opportunities. And now we show the human consequences, the human suffering, but also the human opportunities to deal with the consequences of climate change and to try to set an agenda that will take us far into the 21st century and addressing all the issues. And this comes at a moment that we really see something changing. There will be a big meeting in Bali next month, and the tone for that meeting has been set now by the Australian electorate. I dare say that this is the first elections in history that has been decided by climate change, and is a very welcome development. And what we would like to see in Bali, and that is what this report, Human Solidarity in a Divided World, wants to advocate, is that we know that it's a problem of the rich industrialized world. That is to say, a problem to address, to solve. But the real issue is with many people, in particularly sub-Saharan Africa, large parts of Asia and parts of Latin America, that suffer the consequences of droughts, of floods, of weather events, of reduced agricultural production, of, in summary, less space for development just at the time that many economies in the developing world are picking up as never before. And we need to turn that around, and that is the message of this report.
Thank you. Dr. Brilliant, how will climate change affect the poor people, and what are you doing at Google.org to address some of the things that, that Mr. Melker just mentioned?
Thank you, Greg. It's really nice to be here and see so many friends in the audience. I think to give you an idea of the difference between the way we have the luxury to look at climate change in the West and the way it looks to a poor farmer in Tanzania or a fisherman in Tamil Nadu, even the tenses we use to describe it are different. We say it will happen to our children or our grandchildren. We say there's an inflection point. We argue if it's 10 years from now or 50 years from now. We argue whether we'll see melting of the glaciers in 50 or 100 years. We're using the future tense. But if you're a farmer in Tanzania or a farmer in Andhra Pradesh, the tense is the present tense. There have been 20,000 suicides in Andhra Pradesh in India. Farmers can't produce enough calories of food per hectare of land compared to what they used to do in the past. And climate change morally is a problem that hits the poor and the weak the hardest. And it almost doesn't matter what variable you look at, whether it's drinking water, floods, crop yields, nutrition, or vector-borne diseases of malaria. It's the poor in the developing countries who'll be hurt the most. And just to give you an idea of the irony of it, Muhammad Yunus, who won the Nobel Prize for this amazing thing that he has done with microcredit, everything that he has done, the 5 million women to whom Grameen Bank have given loans in Bangladesh, all that could be washed away if there's a rise of 2 meters in sea level. In fact, I was just reading a statistic watching these floods that each millimeter rise in sea level corresponds to 1.5 meters of shoreline loss. That means the 1 meter of sea level rise, which is the most optimistic projection that I've seen, corresponds to 1 mile of seashore rise. That means Sausalito. It means we don't have to worry too much about the shape of the 9/11 memorial because it'll be underwater. These are the things that affect people in Tanzania and the coast of Africa and India the greatest. So Google.org is trying to look at those issues. We're certainly looking at malaria. Last year, 1.5 million children died of malaria. That number could double or triple or more as the Anopheles mosquito is now able to live at higher altitudes. It won't have the seasonal die-off from the winters that won't take place. We need to look at those issues. We need to look at salt in the water. To some extent, climate change is an issue about drinking water. We may be worried more about peak water than peak oil 50 years from now. So we're investing heavily in that. And this morning, Google announced that we will be investing heavily in renewable energies in a quest to make electricity from renewable energy cheaper than electricity from coal, which is one part of the solution.
Thank you. Nancy Fund, you manage a fund that invests in startup companies that aim to make money while also protecting the environment and perhaps cleaning it up. What role can startups and private companies play in addressing these concerns we're talking about?
Well, I think that startups can pursue innovative solutions to the vast problems that we face in trying to turn the climate change equation around. Startups can't do it alone. I think there's a key requirement for leadership in public policy to set the conditions that then make investors attracted to innovative products. But certainly startups, especially where we live here in Silicon Valley in the Bay Area, have shown us that they can scale major change. And so what startups in this area and really throughout the world are doing is pursuing technologies such as biofuels or large-scale solar or new forms of PV or other materials that bring the cost of solar down to a more accessible level. These are all of the tools that we need going forward to tackle the problems that we face. And because they are private sector solutions, although I want to stress that they do depend on good public policy, they are able to scale. They are able to grow and hire people and expand. And I think that that will be the key in correcting some of these problems on a global scale, because you really do need that size of investment, that global approach to tackle something like this.
Thank you. Andrea Gardner, you work for a $5 billion global firm, and which is involved in something called the Business Council on Climate Change, which is connected to the United Nations. Can you tell us a little bit about that effort and how the large companies are trying to reduce their carbon emissions?
Sure. I also want to restate that it is a privilege to be on this panel, and thank you all for your time to be here today. The Business Council on Climate Change is an organization of Bay Area businesses who want to take action now to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions and make a positive effect on climate change. And within the United States, as we know, the federal government hasn't necessarily taken the actions and the steps we'd like to see to help address this problem, and a lot is going on at the local level now, and this is a good example of that. City of San Francisco is participating in the UN Global Compact Cities Pilot Program. And this is one of the efforts they've initiated to address and achieve some of the goals that they want to, including a 20% reduction in the city's greenhouse gas emissions by 2020, I believe. The Business Council on Climate Change, we've established a framework of principles to which all the members have committed themselves. And these are members that range from companies like ours, 5 billion global companies, down to small companies of two or three members, all of whom really want to make a difference and start taking action. We've established an advisory committee that has set up working groups, established goals and objectives for those working groups, and we're now moving forward on implementing those. And the key of this is the businesses working together to help each other. It's easy to look up ideas about things you can do in energy efficiency and so on to reduce your own greenhouse gas emissions. But there's a lot of challenges in actually implementing these programs, and this is a forum from which we can learn from each other. And the hope is that this is a model that can be, this framework, be taken to other cities and other regions in the U.S. and around the world and be used for businesses to take action there.
Great, thanks. I'd like to begin our joint discussion sort of starting on the high ground and talk about whether there is sort of a moral dimension to this, whether the large industrialized countries that have emitted so much pollution have a moral imperative or obligation to address these things, and what's the balance between sort of the morals and the market for anyone who'd like to address that. Ann?
Well, I'd certainly like to start because the moral responsibility is there. I mean, one cannot deny that the consequences of the Industrial Revolution, they all stem from what has happened in just a limited part of the world, with just a minority of world citizens involved and benefiting from that Industrial Revolution. Now, these days, we see a rapid change with the industrialization of China and India and other countries that is radically changing the world. But the consequences of the industrialization of the past two centuries are there now and will be there now for the next 100 years or so. And therefore, there's now a double-edged sword. It's the moral side, but it's also the survival side, which brings then developing and developed countries in one basket, because it's certainly also our interest and China's interest to bring all of us together in working out a global compact, indeed, on addressing the consequences of climate change. So it starts with the moral argument, but there's now a very strong economic and survival argument at stake, and that brings the world community together as never before.
Anyone else on that, Larry?
Well, I think Ed said it perfectly. If you take a look at China, what the Chinese have done in the last 30 years is historic, amazing. 300 million people pulled out of poverty and into the middle class. That's an accomplishment greater than the pyramids, greater than almost anything you can think of in history. But there's 300 million more waiting in line, and 300 million more behind them, and then 300 million more. And in order to get that next 300 million out of poverty, China has to sustain a growth rate which is really double digits. It's hard to imagine how else you create the jobs that bring people out of poverty. And how do you do that? How do you sustain that growth rate unless you burn coal, which is what they're doing now? And when you talk to the Chinese or you talk to Indians and you say, but what about global pollution? They'll say, what about you? we don't have the moral standing to even begin that conversation because, you know, Africa has produced less than 2% of the greenhouse gases. It's kind of hard to go to Africa from the United States and say, what about you? So it's a moral issue. It's an issue of responsibility even more than morality. We have a fiduciary responsibility to the world. We have to solve this problem. We can't go and say to the Chinese or to the Indians or the Africans, no, you can't bring more people out of poverty. That's not the right way to do it. We have to look here. We have to look at ourselves. We have to find the solutions here.
So would anyone go so far as to say that there is a right to pollute, that there is an equal right among everyone to pollute?
Well, there's an inevitability to pollute. When you're without electricity, you want to get connected. Now, sometimes, I just saw it myself, in Nepal, you can do that with running water from the mountains, and that's great. But there are also places where you need coal or another classic fuel to get your electricity. And there's a right for people, yes, I dare say, there's a right for people to have a minimum standard of decent living possible for them. And that will take its toll. But the levels that we're talking about are incomparable with the carbon footprints that are out here in the US, in Canada, or in Europe. The difference in carbon footprint between the US and Ethiopia is 200-fold. And that's what we're talking about. So let's not turn around the argument. We can provide access to electricity, and we should do it for all the poor that are lacking it now. And at the same time, we are able to address the consequences of climate change because they start with us at our level.
Isn't it also true that the energy intensity or the carbon footprint of European countries that have living standards, material living standards, comparable to the U.S., they have comparable living standards but lower energy consumption? Is that also the case?
Yes, it is the case.
although,
I mean, there's a variety of situations in Europe, but in the report we also show that there's still quite a difference between the carbon footprint in North America and in most of the European countries, difference of 2 or 3 fold, which really is quite huge, but also in Europe. The task to live up to the standards and the standard that we propose for 2050 is still a very huge task ahead, and they're still far away from achieving it.
Can I,
Nancy?
Just not to be too provincial, but I do think that it's important to point out, and it relates to my earlier comment about the importance of public policy, that California is actually an exception to the rule in terms of, over the past 30 years, while our population has grown and our output has grown, our per capita energy consumption has stayed fairly constant, and it's because of the leadership of groups like the California Energy Commission, the Public Utilities Commission, that really did take a lead way back in the 70s to enforce standards for energy efficiency in appliances, and moved from there to today, where we have renewable portfolio standards that are encouraging, requiring and getting utilities to really tackle the problem of introducing more renewables into their energy mix. And so we're seeing large-scale solar plants being built. We're seeing incentives for PV. So that I think we have a really extraordinary lesson in California's 30 years of policy. We're not perfect, obviously, but we do have some lessons here at home to create a sense of hope in a way that the Europeans have in more explicitly.
Well, let me even go beyond that. I think California is really ahead of European countries, and also with your Global Warming Solutions Act, you're really setting in many ways the tone and the pace of what is needed also in Europe.
Andrea, did you want to?
Yeah, just a quick comment. And you had said, do we think there's a right to pollute as a basis of the discussion? But I think that's not the best way to look at it. As Dr. Melkert said, it's the right to some basic standards of living. And I think framing it in that rather than the right to pollute could potentially open a lot more solutions.
Sure. So we're talking about the interaction between policy and business. If Nancy, I understand you sort of saying that policy needs to be out front and create an environment where businesses can do their thing. So policy leaders and then business leaders step in behind that. Is that?
Well, absolutely. It's too much to ask a utility, which is historically has been a regulated business, so it sort of does things the same way, to all of a sudden launch into solar. I mean, without there being certain policies that encourage them to do that. And so I think that the genius of what California did over the past few decades is to implement policies like renewable portfolio standards that require utilities to find renewable sources of energy. And so what that does is it sends a signal to the marketplace, to investors, to venture capitalists, to the whole community that, hey, this is serious. There's, we're a large energy user here in the state, so there's a lot of power that needs to come from renewables. So we need to do some investing in order to make this happen because the tools are not there. So with that, you get the venture capital community to take the risk and to invest in these companies. And they wouldn't do it, frankly. We wouldn't do it if we didn't see those RPS policies, if we didn't see AB 32, if we didn't see that roadmap ahead that says the future will be very different than the past, you wouldn't see investors turning to the sector, and then you wouldn't have 400 megawatt plants being built in the Mojave Desert, over the next 10 years that are going to allow utilities to draw some of their power from solar. And then you wouldn't be able to take that plant, make it even cheaper, and put it in North Africa somewhere. Right.
Larry, that might be a chance to talk a little more about Google becoming an energy company. Why is it doing it? What does it expect out of it? And
well, thanks for that softball question.
I got hardballs later. Don't worry.
Google this morning announced that we were going to make Google.org was going to make a series of investments in a lot of the kinds of companies that Nancy is way ahead of us on and has invested in some great companies, and there's some wonderful companies out there. But we also announced that as we grow and we consume more energy, we're aware that we're becoming part of the problem, and we don't want to be part of the problem. We want to be part of the solution. So we're going to invest heavily and build an internal R&D effort so we can make renewable electricity for us and for others at prices cheaper than coal. And I think that's really the benchmark. While venture capitalists are pouring lots of money into great companies, the goal of which is to reduce the price per kilowatt hour of renewable energy, electricity from renewable energies, it really has to be a price that's less than coal. I lived in India 10 years. I can assure you every single lump of coal in India will be burned if there isn't a cheaper solution for heat and power and light. So we have to have that. And Google's announcement today is that we've got 8,000 engineers. Usually they're doing something else. But we're going to try to do everything we can to add to be one of the many, many groups that's trying to solve these problems by trying to build much lower cost renewable energy.
We have a question here from our audience about an aspect of this that's often overlooked, and that is there any connection between global warming and human population growth rates? The population of the Earth projected to grow from, what, 6 to 9 billion?
Can I grab that one? So not very far from here in Stanford in the 1950s, Paul Ehrlich wrote a book called The Population Bomb, and he projected that by today's date there'd be 20 billion people living on Earth. Well, in fact, there's 6.5 billion, and we've dodged that bullet. In fact, all the projections say that we will level off at about 9.5 billion people. The problem is we may be 9 billion and not 20 billion, but we eat like we were 20 billion, and we have a carbon footprint like we were 20 billion, and we didn't know what a carbon footprint was then. So there's very definitely a relationship. And, you can just look at all the different indices. 30 years ago, China had 1 billion people. Today, it's 1.35 billion, a 35% growth rate. But 30 years ago, China had less than 50 million chickens. And today, it's got 15 billion chickens. So people are consuming more proteins. We have a much greater lifestyle. Of course, there's a more than linear relationship between the growth of the population and the carbon footprint that we've created.
question here about what can realistically be expected from the Bali talks, and perhaps we could tie these together. Will the next round of international discussions about climate change include things such as population and these other dimensions, Mr. Melker?
Well, Bali is really meant to be the start of a process of 1 or 2 years to pull together the world community behind a new treaty, because the Kyoto Treaty, which was in fact the first effort to address climate change at a global level, will expire in its operational commitments after 2012. So it's really high time to get something new on the table. And I think the prospects for Bali are increasingly good, because the climate change panel of the UN has now been really very authoritative in saying that nobody can any longer ignore the issue. I referred to the Australian elections. It's really a very important and extremely welcome signal at the eve of Bali that now the new Prime Minister has said, I'll go to Bali, be there myself, and commit my country to cooperate. It's a major breakthrough, in my view. And then I also have seen in the U.S. A lot of change. California is extremely important, what has happened here, also in other states. In New York, where I'm living, there's quite a lot going on. President Bush accepted an invitation by the Secretary General to join a dinner last September to discuss this. One can, of course, say, well, what is in it, just a dinner? But one can also see it from another angle and say it was a breakthrough, that it was a recognition that something has to be done, some commitment has to be shown. And I believe that the successor to Kyoto will really be a worldwide subscribed to new treaty. And when I say worldwide, it's important not to look only at the Europeans and the North Americans, but also this time China, India, Brazil. Certainly they can claim a different approach, a staged approach, another level of contribution to the solution of the problem, but they have to be part of the solution, because otherwise we will try to solve something in the north and we will run behind the facts in the south.
You welcome Australia joining the Kyoto regime. However, I believe most countries that signed it are not meeting the targets. So what will be the real benefit of Australia joining? And will the next round have some penalties for countries that sign but don't meet the guidelines that they promised to meet?
Well, the situation is even worse, because quite a few countries who signed up to Kyoto have not achieved the goals, including in Europe. So a lot more has to be done. But when we compare the situation now with around the 1990s, which was really the first wave of awareness and of action, a lot has changed. And the feeling that something very fundamental is going on is now very widely acknowledged, and that was certainly not the case around the 1990s. So I think the basis is a lot stronger. There's much more investment these days in science, in technology, and in capital to try to contribute to finding solutions, and the composition of this panel is really also is a testimony of that. And then if the world now would finally be able to rally together without exceptions, it will also be easier to create a level playing field that really will make more progress possible. And finally, on penalties, I think that there are good examples to learn that penalties may sometimes help, but most of the times is not the key. Let me just give you one example, which is very relevant for this discussion. In 1987, there was the Montreal Treaty on the ozone layer, which was then the big issue. Now, there was recently, in September, a meeting on 20 years anniversary of the protocol, and it is amazing what has been achieved. 95% of the objectives worldwide, without any exception, has been achieved, and without penalties, but just by setting a very clear target and rallying technology, capital, science, and citizens' involvement behind that goal. So that should also be possible with addressing climate change and the greenhouse gases.
We've been talking about California as a leader and lauding some of its accomplishments. One question from the audience says, global carbon emissions are 45 billion tons per year and projected to grow to 70 billion by 2030. If AB 32, which is the California greenhouse law, is effective, it'll reduce only a small portion of that. So is AB 32 really going to mean meaningful change, or is it just a feel-good measure to address our conscience? Nancy?
I think it's going to revolutionize the way the world thinks about these issues. I mean, we all know that when things happen in California, they get watched and copied elsewhere in the world, and you're already seeing states that you wouldn't even expect, North Carolina, coming up with their own carbon footprint policies and such. So I can't say emphatically enough that what California does is important beyond its own consumption trends, and yet it is, as the largest state, a key player in our national emissions. And so anything in this report, it points out that 30% of carbon load comes from personal transportation, and we see that every day here in California. And anything we can do to, you know, drive electric vehicles, drive alternative transportation modalities, we're really going to make an impact on the largest state and the largest producer of personal transportation emissions. But then also this replication that we'll see throughout the world, I think, is extremely important.
We're discussing global climate change at the Commonwealth Club, and our panelists are Larry Brilliant, Executive Director of Google.org, Ad Melkert, Undersecretary General of the United Nations, Nancy Fund, Managing Director at J.P. Morgan, and Andrea Gardner, Sustainable Solutions Manager at CH2M Hill. The amount of change required here is so staggering. Who's going to be the biggest driver of this change? Is it going to be private companies? Is it going to be international organizations? Can they move fast enough? Is it going to be state governments? Who's going to really be out front on this, Larry?
Yeah, I think it's got to be all of them. But going back to what Nancy said, AB 32 really is revolutionary in the United States. And last I heard, 35 or 40% of the states have model legislation that's exactly the same as AB 32. And we may be in a situation when the federal government is non-responsive of having the state governments enact that legislation and percolating it up to the top, so that when you have that many state houses that have come on board, then the feds will have to come on board. So that's, I think that's one of the major actors in this drama.
But there are those who say no matter what the U.S. does, as you mentioned, coal in China and India can blow everything away. So how do we address that?
By having them, first of all, in the international engagement. I mean, let's not forget, they were out of the Kyoto commitment, and this is going to be a new step. And secondly, by also stepping up cooperation, transfer of technology. I think the capital, particularly in China and India, will do a lot to bring it to the places where it really will lead to a lot of benefits, provided that clear ceilings are set and governments also subscribe to those ceilings. That must not only be a matter here, that is also for New Delhi and for Beijing really the thing to do. And in that sense, it's still a very open issue also in the Bali conference next month, because it's actually the first time that we're going to ask from the developing countries and from the middle-income countries in particular to have their share. But that's why it's so important that when we ask that to them, that it's also clear that the industrialized world is ready to take the largest part of what is needed. And that's why we propose in our report that with a 50% all-over reduction by 2050, 80% of that would have to be taken by the industrialized world and 20% by what is now called the developing world, but which is really mainly China, India, Brazil, and some others.
Which gets to the big point about who pays for all of this. I believe the Stern Commission had an estimate of net costs from 5%. One scenario had even net savings. The median cost of greenhouse gas stabilization at around 550 parts per million is about 1% of GDP. the big question in Washington and struggles, who ultimately is going to pay for this? Who in the United States and who among countries? And how do you think that's going to play out?
Doesn't this sound like a bargain to you? I mean, 1% of GDP to stay alive and keep the earth for our children and grandchildren. I mean, I'd make that bet. I mean, that doesn't sound like such a big bet to make. I'd flip it around. Who wouldn't be willing to pay that?
Well, we were talking back earlier that some of our political leadership is backing away from these very laws. There's, what, 9 or 10 bills in the Congress to reduce or stabilize greenhouse gas emissions.
And what does that make them?
Yeah. So if the politicians aren't leading, then how's it going to happen?
Well, I think Larry said a few minutes ago that the states are ahead of the federal government here, and we have the power to set the example and move the ball forward. And we've seen in other policy areas where the feds have been slow and have caught up, you know, X years later. So I think it just makes it more important to get the policies right so that you attract investment. I think that it will be a great day, and it's going to happen shortly when we have companies out there that are as famous as Google that are saving the planet. I mean, it's just, you know, you can make a career in this. You can innovate in a way that eliminates some of these problems, or at least contributes to their elimination, and you can do that in a way that you're not sacrificing your own quality of life and ability to feed your children. And so I think infusing sort of our whole entrepreneurial capitalistic model with this environmental ethic and with the possibility for building a career and a famous, you know, series of companies is going to be a great inflection point, because then you'll attract more talent. You'll get people that decide not to go, you know, work in the cell phone industry and decide to work here, and not to pick on the cell phone industry, because, of course, that's been a huge advance for people all over the world. But we do need to attract that talent, and that will help pay the bills.
I'd like to add one more thing. I don't see this come up too often, but I think it's a really important concern when we look at, for the federal government, looking at security issues. And when you think about a lot of these areas in question, they're going to be really affected by rising sea levels and so on, and drought. There's a lot of them are politically unstable regions, and now you're talking about displacing tens of millions of people. In the interest of security, it seems that it would be a terrific investment to try and help these areas and avoid future conflicts of similar to what we might be going
sure.
have going
Ed
on.
I think it's a very important point, because it points at the price that we're paying today already. Look at the conflict in Darfur. Yeah. It's very much related to the drought and to people competing for fertile soil and where to go with the cattle, etc. Or let me take an example close at my heart, the Netherlands. We're paying $3 billion a year to defend just a tiny piece of land of 40,000 square kilometers. And when you project that at a larger picture of Bangladesh, or even if you want to come closer home, lower Manhattan, and I even don't know how it's here in California, it's something, or the Sierra Nevada measures that you have to take here in terms of your water provision. We're paying already a big price these days. The question is, do we just pay a price to run behind the facts, or do we take the kind of preventive measures that will, in the end, create a sustainable basis? And that's what we need to look for.
And if I could, Greg, there's even the cost that we can't anticipate. Everybody's worried, and rightfully so, about bird flu. But we don't realize that there have been 39 novel emerging communicable diseases, new viruses, that have jumped species from animals to humans, any one of which could become a pandemic, many of which have become epidemic. And the reason they're jumping species is because we're running out of water, because with rising temperature, the Anopheles mosquito goes in different places, but so does dengue and hemorrhagic fever. And our way of life is more at peril from the things that we can't even see or articulate than it is from losing a few conveniences. I think we've got it out of whack. I think that we 1% or 5% would be a bargain to preserve a world in which these unseen horrors don't get a chance to gain a toehold.
But do you think the existing political situation in the U.S. will recognize and act upon those costs in a system that's always... This is a long-term problem, and they're a short-term institution.
The last time I read, it was a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And it's up to us and to your listeners. We need to understand how what this moment of time is, and we need to fully understand what the consequences of inaction are. I'm confident that this country will do the right thing when enough of us understand that.
We're discussing global climate change at the Commonwealth Club, and our panelists are Larry Brilliant, Executive Director of Google.org, Ad Melkert, Undersecretary General of the United Nations, Nancy Fun, Managing Director of J.P. Morgan, and Andrea Gardner, Sustainable Solutions Manager at CH2M Hill. I'm Greg Dalton with the Commonwealth Club. The question of nuclear power inevitably comes up, and we have several here for Nancy and for Larry. Does nuclear power part of a renewable portfolio?
I think I heard it said best, even if you're for nuclear power, you have to be able to get over two hurdles. One, is there truly enough uranium in the world that if you were able to exploit it all, you could actually make a measurable difference in the need for renewable energy? And I think most experts say there's just not enough uranium. The second thing that I've heard is that if you could build a nuclear power plant that produced electricity funded entirely by private capital without government subsidies and make it price competitive with any of the other renewable energies we're talking about, then let's have the conversation. But until those two threshold barriers are met, it isn't even a topic of conversation for me.
Right. Anyone who builds a nuclear power plant, there's a federal exemption from risk. That they can't be sued. There's caps. That's a huge risk subsidy for building, underwriting the price of a nuclear power plant. Nancy?
Well, this just brings up the larger issue, is that we have a lot of subsidies for other technologies that renewables don't have, and we're struggling to get an ITC passed in Congress that would help renewables when nuclear and fossil fuel-based energy sources really... it's a very unlevel playing field.
An investment tax credit, ITC?
The extending the investment tax credit to apply to investments in renewables is a very popular idea, but has not gone through the Congress yet because of some of the political issues that we've been talking about. But I agree with Larry that nuclear, given all of the requirements around it, is not a viable, cost-effective technology when you compare it to others. And I would like to see much more of our, if we're going to have incentive dollars, we should throw some of them at these renewables, because in the long run, that's going to have a much better cost-benefit equation.
What other financing mechanisms could be brought? There's a question here about renewable energy, muni bonds for renewable energies. What other sorts of financing mechanism would you like to see as a business person to spur the investment in direct capital, both here in the United States and overseas?
Well, certainly investment tax credit would be one of them. There's such an abundance of opportunities at the local level. Recently in the city of Berkeley here, the mayor and the city council decided to take away the upfront expense of installing solar and instead add it as a surcharge to your property tax over an extended period, which is a huge innovation to get rid of one of the fundamental barriers that people often have, is that upfront cost, which is fairly substantial, to installing solar. So that's a great policy innovation, and apparently that city is getting calls from all over the world. You know, how did you do that? How can we replicate it? Now, I'm sure it will be more difficult to implement than it is to just describe it, but that's an approach that, you know, could happen at the local level. And there's everything in between. I mean, these AB 32 regulations that are being worked on, the renewable portfolio standards. Certainly, there are issues relating to transmission, because as you get into these large-scale solar plants, which can generate, you know, the hundreds of megawatts and eventually gigawatts of power that really move the needle, at least in many parts of the U.S., especially California, we have not invested in transmission infrastructure to pull that, to take that power to where it's needed, and so that's something that public policy should really begin to address and bring in FERC and the various agencies that need to take care of that.
Some about the presidential election here in the United States, and most of the candidates have ideas here for directing billions of dollars to various types of new energy, renewable energy. I think it goes as high as $150 billion from Obama. What do you think about the effectiveness of the government going in and sort of investing tens of billions of dollars in specific areas beyond the tax credits you've talked about and some of the other things?
Well, I'm not familiar with the specific proposals. I would just say that it's probably a good idea to create incentives for the private sector to innovate and invest rather than having the government choose the winners and losers.
Would you agree with that, Larry?
I'd like to see a tremendous amount of investment in research and development, in career building, and young people, engineers especially, who go into this field. I think that's the proper use of government and government funds. The last I saw was this administration is spending less than $500 million total in R&D in renewable energy. If you think about that compared to other expenditures, it would make you scratch your head a little bit.
Actually, Larry touched on a good point, which is the shortfall of engineers that we're going to be experiencing in the next 10 to 15 years. I think we're going to be something like 6 million engineers short, and a significant number are going to be retiring, again, over the next 10 to 15 years and taking a lot of that experience with them. And we actually desperately need to get more investment in our engineering education.
Could I just add, I mean, I'm not going to say anything about presidential candidates. I'm quite lucky, I suppose. But could I just add that in any earmark of money, the support to the poorest developing countries would not be forgotten. I mean, we have made a calculation that around $86 billion per year will be needed worldwide in order to support the poorest countries in bringing their infrastructure up to date, in protecting people, in insuring people. That's a lot more than is at this moment available, and obviously it would be very important that the United States and other major donors would contribute to that, really on top of what they're doing now for development cooperation, and I would hope that that also would be part of the promise of any candidate with any chance to win.
Though historically the United States is reluctant to fund the UN, it has a low proportion of foreign aid compared to its economy. We haven't been the most generous country in that respect, but you think that can change?
Well, I think that when people would see the role that the UN and the Secretary General are now playing to bring all parties together in Bali, and when people would start, would be aware that this is really also in the interest of any American citizen, I think that could help a lot also to make understand how important it is to have an institution like the UN, even if you don't always like what you see. But that may be the case with other institutions as well.
I would just add, Andrea, that I think that as a country, you know, we're seeing on a daily basis the impact of the expenditures for supporting military campaigns that many of us question. And when you see, you know, a child health bill held up in Congress and because they don't want to spend that money, and then you see how much is spent in these military activities, I think Americans are, you know, increasingly disturbed with that, because obviously investments in prenatal health, child health are some of the best investments you can make.
I've been very impressed with a campaign called the One Campaign, which was started by Bono. And this is a campaign which has 5 million Americans as members already. And they have a pledge that they have circulated to all the campaigns for everyone running for president of the United States. And they've been very successful in getting the candidates, Republicans and Democrats, to sign on that if they are elected president, they will do exactly what Ad said. in terms of supporting the UN. I'm extremely pleased that they've added that they would also pledge to fight against malaria, fight for malaria eradication, and fight for climate adaptation for the poorest countries who have the least resources to fight. I think that's the best way to get social activism, and I'm hopeful that that will be successful.
One of the reasons that we don't know so much about the candidates' positions on climate change is they don't talk about it very much, and that's because any political operative will tell you if you pull about the environment, it falls lower down after Iraq, the economy, et cetera. You start to talk about it as energy security, it starts to rise. So that raises the question about, are we framing this issue as climate change? Is that the right way to frame it if you really want that political engagement or that political leadership you've been talking about?
Well, I think it will become a big issue after next month's meeting that every candidate will have to say to which extent or in which way are you going to commit the United States to an international agreement and with which kind of objectives, and then the objectives of the act here in California or other examples would certainly play an important role in that debate.
I would just add that increasingly people, most people, when you look at the elections, the economy is often very central in how the outcomes, if you look historically. But I think people are increasingly getting it that the environment is very key to economic prosperity, and that you can turn around a lot of environmental problems at the same time that you're building a new source of economic vitality. So I think we'll see more of it, and to the extent that we can tie it to these economic issues, I think we'll be successful politically, because just that's where a lot of decisions are made, is based on economic issues.
I think, though, that there's still, especially when you get to the middle part of the U.S., there's still a very deep perception that the environment is this thing over there where there's some grass and some bugs and bunnies, and it doesn't really have anything to do with me on a day-to-day basis. And I think we really do need to change the way we frame it. It has a lot to do with the water that comes out of your tap, your national security, and things like that. We really need to make it more direct.
There's also a perception that it's the environmentalism is sort of an upper class Caucasian concern, and it's easy to talk about here at the Commonwealth Club in the Bay Area, but it's perceived very differently elsewhere. Nancy?
That's a common perception, but I think that just so much is happening to change that, and issues of environmental justice are being addressed. You have our mayor here in San Francisco working to make Hunter's Point an environmental business zone. You have the Enterprise Zone in Richmond, where the old Ford plant from World War II, where Rosie the Riveter actually worked, is now the headquarters for Powerlight, which is a division of SunPower. And these are companies and projects that are bringing economic activity to low-income neighborhoods, creating green-collar jobs. So I think that there is some good news happening that is recognizing that we need to address the disparities of income related to environmental degradation.
I think this is for Mr. Melker. There's a question here to talk a little more about solutions or mechanisms that will allow the developed countries to aid emissions reductions in the developing countries. You know, what's going to happen here? How can we specifically help reduce carbon emissions in China, India, et cetera, as they become bigger emitters?
Well, I think there the carbon credit trading is very important. It's still a complex market to trade, basically, between the investments in developing countries and offsetting that to the way that the industrialized countries can then have part of their share transferred to other countries. We are trying to make that more to the advantage also of poorer countries, because right now it's mainly China and Mexico and Brazil that are benefiting from that trading scheme. But it has shown, particularly in China, I think, that it can have a very good effect. And the other thing is transfer of technology, particularly to the poorest countries. And that would be helped a lot by pricing carbon emissions at the right level so that it gets economically interesting to invest and also to sell technology. So there's a combination of policy measures and market incentives needed to engage also the developing countries.
Andrea?
I'd add there's a lot of small-scale opportunities, I think, as well for technology transfer. One example that we were involved in rebuilding after the tsunami in Sri Lanka, going back in and helping design and build some of the buildings, actually took the opportunity to help launch a school locally and train local people in green building design and construction. So they were trained on the job and in creating this school, and then they could continue to educate people locally so they could implement that technology right there.
Andrea, maybe you can tell us a little more about BC3. It's been a couple years since that was formed, some companies getting together saying they're going to do some good things. How much have they actually done so far, and is that kind of collaboration going to really yield results fast enough to address the challenge we're talking about?
I think so. It was actually officially launched March of this year.
Okay.
After they lined up members and got some initial work done. And we spent the last few months, as I described at the beginning, developing the framework, finalizing the principles, setting up the working groups, figuring out how we'd want to share the efforts, how to set it up financially, and so on. And most of that has been resolved. I should add that we wanted to take the time to set it up in such a way that it would be a replicable model. So it took a little extra time. We certainly have members who are ready to dive in and do something now, and certainly members have already done some things on their own. And I think in January you should start to see a lot more activity. We should be rolling out the new website. There'll start being monthly panels and meetings to share specific experience. A couple of the first things we're going to be doing, one is a panel and some case studies on how to make changes if you lease your office space. So a lot of the companies that are members do not own their buildings and don't have any direct ability to, for instance, change their lighting, change their HVAC system. So a panel to show how you can actually work with your building managers to make those changes. And we're going to have another one on setting up to address transit. How do you set up green fleets, get car sharing going, things like that, with the range of transit programs that are available.
There's a question here from the audience for you about whether compliance is voluntary in this regime, if there are any penalties for not meeting, complying with this compact.
It's actually one of the more challenging questions we're dealing with. One of the principles is internal implementation, setting a baseline, setting targets, and developing a plan and implementing it to reduce emissions. And we're still discussing that right now, specifically what we want to set. There's a lot of the members are already involved in, California Climate Action Registry, Sustainable Silicon Valley, and some other organizations that have set, through which they've already set targets. And so we may just roll some of that in so people don't have to duplicate their reporting. So that is something still under discussion.
One question here is that what would you most like to see in terms of changes in lifestyle, changes in policy, changes in consumer practices? What would you each like to see that to really make a difference in this?
it's interesting. This conversation's almost come completely full circle. When Ed was talking about the cap and trade system, I was thinking that what that really is it's a system that allocates a certain amount of pollution per person or per company or per country, which was the moral question that we began this conversation with, which is there a moral right to pollute?
Right.
And so the cap and trade system institutionalizes the moral right to pollute, but not to pollute too much. and I think that notion has under it utilitarianism and a concept that we're all in it together and that we each have only this much that we can do of good or harm. I think that's what I'd like to see happen. I'd like to see this notion that it's one world, we're one species, and we're all in it together. Everything else is secondary. If we understand that the consequences of climate change are because we don't share the belief that we're all in it together, we'll continue using the atmosphere like a toilet. We have to believe that, and that's the change I'd like to see.
Nancy?
I'd like to see us let go of our belief that energy use is tied to coal and fossil fuel and really build a renewables future and not have these doubts that, you know, we can't get to the gigawatt level and we can't make an imprint. We just have to get started, and I believe that it will happen, that it will scale, and that we'll be able to bring the cost down and make it more widely available. And coincident with that, I would also love to see us let go of this notion that cars need to be fueled by gasoline and really look at electricity and other approaches, especially solar-powered electric vehicles. To me, seem like a real solution and one that we can work toward, at least in a big part of the world.
Andrea?
I'd even go beyond that and say to realize we don't even need cars. It would be a wonderful world if we didn't need a car. You could walk to your job, walk to stores. Sort of along that line, my wish list would probably be to have people realize that consumption in our consumption culture and our consumption economic model does not equal quality of life. And in fact, I think people who kind of get off the consume a lot, buy a lot, and keep up with the Joneses actually experience a much better quality of life. And it would be great to see that shift.
There's even some talk, and most of the pollution regimes have been focused on source of production and emission. There's some talk now about looking at carbon and the consumption side, taxing consumers rather than the emitters, the factories in China, because an emitter-based regime creates an incentive to stick the dirty factories somewhere else, whereas if you focus on consumption, then you quickly get to the developed economies and rich countries and states like California. Look at the ultimate drivers of demand for that production. Sorry. Ed, what would you like to see to wrap up?
Well, this would certainly be interesting, but it's very complicated, and certainly very complicated to apply that at a global level. I would actually like to add, because everything that was mentioned is relevant, but I would like to add the aspect of solidarity. I mean, to some it may sound as an old-fashioned word, but it's very, very modern, really literally needed in terms of addressing climate change, as we're all part of it. We're all in it. Nobody can escape. So solidarity is the only way that would bring us to a kind of sustainability over a long period of time. And it's also solidarity between generations that we need, because what we're talking here in terms of solutions is about things that, pardon me, but most of us won't see with our own eyes anymore. It's about our children, it's about our grandchildren, and it's about the children and grandchildren of the people living in other parts of the world. And that's what has made the authors of our report also select this great quote of Martin Luther King when he said, where do we go from here, chaos or community? And I think it's extremely well fit for addressing this problem and seeing the way forward.
And a fitting end to our program, please thank our panelists.
Thank you.
We've been discussing global climate change at the Commonwealth Club with Larry Brilliant, Executive Director of Google.org, Ad Melkert, Undersecretary General of the United Nations, Nancy Fun, Managing Director of J.P. Morgan, and Andrea Gardner, Sustainable Solutions Manager at CH2M Hill. I'm Greg Talton, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.